We're live. Oh dear God. I knew we were live. I'm just looking at my facial hair seems a little more uneven than usual these days. Good evening, everybody. Before we get into anything, is my audio good? Everyone, Richard Christensen, if you say F, I'm going to think there's something seriously going on. Is this okay? How is the audio, everybody? Don't mess with me. I don't have earbuds in and yet. Is there another F now? Someone else is saying it. Hajja, I'm going to think you're serious. Okay, the gag is over, people. How is everybody doing tonight? This is going to be a good one. Sounds good, man. Okay, thank you, Joe Leisure, to not play on a, you know, jokes on a guy who's easily duped. This is going to be an amazing stream. What can I say? I love getting to meet new people in the streams. Like, I'm not sure if anybody remembers, but I met Robert Barnes through the internet. He came on to talk about the Sandman case. We talked for, I think it was a good half hour about his life. I met Cernovich through the internet. We talked a good hour where we got to know everything about Cernovich growing up, you know, up to where he is now. I met Nate Brody through an online legal battle royale that has blossomed into an amazing friendship. And tonight, I've been watching Robert Grueler for, I mean, on and off, because I watch Robert, like I told him when we were talking before going live, when I have questions on law stories that I don't think I fully understand. Rittenhouse is one, George Floyd was another, and I've gotten some good information from Robert, but the amazing thing is you actually get to know someone online before you meet them in real life, and now we're meeting digitally because I can't leave the country without severe risks of anal swabs. Okay, no, those are not yet in effect. And from what I understand, can't hear a thing you're saying, Viva. How did that come up here? Hold on. Okay, stop it. Now you made me forget what I was thinking about. That's right. I can't go to the States. Everyone says, you know, get on Tim Pool, and Tim Pool invited me. And I said, he likes to do things in person. And I said, I can't go into quarantine with three kids when I come back. I'm sure as heck and sure not going to one of them government facilities. So can't do it until there's free mobility, as there should be in a free country. But we'll see. It's not a war, only a skirmish. Thank you. And I'm going to get to another super chat. We got Viva's new shirts fund. Yes, I should get new shirts. They weren't even that expensive. They're just, I don't like getting new clothes. Look at my jeans. Here. Yeah, I've been wearing the same two pairs of jeans for a year now. Okay, so standard caveats. Nothing in this is going to be legal advice. Super chats, I should be able to get to them. I'll do my best. But if I don't, and you're going to be upset, if I don't give them. I don't like people feeling upset. YouTube takes 30% of super chats. It takes 30% of everything except for AdSense revenue, which we don't know how much they take. But if that irks anybody, there are other ways to support the channel if you so choose. Hey, Viva, could you shout out my brother, Philip, whose birthday today, and he officially joined the Graveyard Club. What's the Graveyard Club? First of all, Philip, happy birthday. But I'm a little nervous. What does the Graveyard Club mean for anybody who knows? I'll Google it afterwards. Someone says, sent you paintings to your P.O. box. I will go check it out. I haven't been there in a few days. For putting up messing with you, Steve, thank you. When I did the last stream, or the stream before last, with John Carpe from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms, and I couldn't hear him, I went into such a panic. It was crazy. Okay, so all that said, we got that out of the way, although I do want to know what the Graveyard Club is. The Graveyard Shift? Okay. Let us bring in Robert Grueler from the R&R Law Group. So for anybody who doesn't know, Robert Grueler has a YouTube channel. He's a criminal lawyer out of, I believe it's Scottsdale, Arizona, but I'm fairly certain it's Arizona. I'm certain it's Arizona. And he's got a practice, and he's got a YouTube channel, and he does some of the most insightful streams you're going to get online, covering some of the more, I wouldn't call them controversial lawsuits, just, you know, the subject matter is such that you're covering stuff that's, you know, unpleasant subject material, which has led to problems. And we're going to get into that. You didn't recall or read my 980. Thank you very much, Bambunga. So It's going to be amazing, but we're going to start with him as a human. I like to get to know the people, and I like to ask the highly personal, invasive questions that other people feel uncomfortable asking. I don't have that filter, but I think it's a good thing because you really get to know someone. And generally speaking, people are mature enough to say they don't want to answer a question if they don't want to answer a question. But I know that Robert is very open on his channel. He talks about personal things as they come up and as they're relevant to subject matter. I see both Robert and Robert, or Robert and Paul, I should say. Let us bring in both and just see how this works. And I'm going to change the structure. Nope, that's not good. That's not good. This is better. And I'll rotate around just to keep it, to keep everyone guessing. Can we hear everybody?
Loud and clear.
Yeah, great color on the shirt.
Oh. Looking good. Looking good.
Match. It's Purple Wednesday. All right. Okay, so Robert, all's well with you.
Yes, indeed.
And Robert, okay, so how are we going to do this? We're going to go, Rob, you are, Rob Grueler is Rob. Robert, you are either Barnes, Paul, or Robert, but it's Rob only for Grueler. Rob, thank you for joining us. This is going to be fantastic.
Thank you, Viva. I'm a huge fan of your work. I've been following you for a long time. Same with Mr. Barnes. We had a conversation, I think, a week or two ago, and it's just a huge honor to be on your channel. I appreciate all the work you both are doing. I'm excited to be here.
And someone's pointing out that it's St. Patrick's Day and none of us are wearing green. All right. Well, it's not St. Patrick's Day without a St. Patrick's Day parade. Robert, let's start from the beginning. I know Robert's going to, Rob Barnes is going to have some questions, but let's just start from the beginning. Who are you? Parents, you know, family, where were you brought up and how did you get into law?
Yeah. So I am a criminal defense attorney. We do have a law firm here in Scottsdale. I was born and raised here in Arizona, and I've basically lived my whole life here. And I went to law school on a whim a little bit. I just decided that I liked political science and I wanted to go out there and make an impact on the world. And, you know, long story short is I wanted to be a prosecutor before I ever wanted to be a criminal defense attorney. So it was sort of an interesting journey on how I got here to where I'm at currently. But we are a criminal defense law firm. We help good people who've been charged with crimes. Our mission is to help people find safety, clarity, and hope in their cases and in their futures. And we represent people on all sorts of criminal charges, things like, you know, DUIs, low-level misdemeanors, high-level misdemeanors, domestic violence, drug offenses. We've worked on some pretty serious felony cases, homicide cases, and things like that. A lot of sexual assaults, crimes involving children, and things of that variety. And I've been a defense attorney my entire career. I've never been a prosecutor. And we have a pretty decent sized firm here in Scottsdale. We've got about 20 people, 7 lawyers who are now on the team, and a couple other in the hopper who are going to come out and join us as soon as they pass the bar and graduate law school. And we've just got a big passion of helping people. You know, I've had some things in my life that have sort of set me back a little bit. And so I can empathize with people who are also struggling with life and struggling to get things back on track. And so we've built a whole firm about it, around it, and we're having a lot of fun. You know, YouTube was something that sort of blossomed into, it's turned into something that I never envisioned it to become. It was mostly just me posting legal videos about basic, boring legal concepts, things like what to do if you get stopped for criminal speeding in Arizona, or what are the penalties for a second offense DUI. And so I was just making videos in that manner. And then suddenly it sort of morphed into this almost political show, but sort of holding the police, the prosecutors, the judges, and the politicians accountable, because I just got so tired of what I see on a day-to-day basis practicing in the courts. I see a lot of corruption and negligence and malfeasance just across the board. And so I wanted to start speaking out about that. And then this sort of blossomed into this channel that we're having a lot of fun with. We've got, you know, a good amount of subscribers and a very interested audience, because I think, as you know, and Mr. Barnes, as you know, this is something that I think people are hungry for now. They're tired of the same old rote talking points that you hear every single day on some of the big corporate media sites, where, you know, I think people are having real conversations on YouTube and some of the other platforms where we can really get into the issues. And, you know, that's how I came across your channel. That's how I came across Robert's channel. And here we are. And so I'm excited to be part of the conversation in the small way that I am.
Originally, why did you want to be a prosecutor?
So, you know, I was a little bit misguided, I would say. So I was a political science undergraduate, and I took a constitutional law class sort of at the very end of my college career. And I'm just kind of by nature somebody who's more, I would say, conservative, more libertarian. And it, back then, I thought that being a prosecutor meant that you were going to go out there and help people. You know, I didn't like the idea that people were committing crimes. I sort of was of the mindset that we could help rehabilitate these people. And I was under the misguided, I would say, apprehension that the law is about restoration or it's about rehabilitation. I just didn't realize that that's really not how it works. And so when I was in my first year in law school, I was that really aggressive prosecutorial type of guy. You know, I was sitting there going, nope, that defendant shouldn't get his Miranda rights. That person, that search was totally legal. We shouldn't even be questioning that. The cops are right. You know, and I was sort of that kind of guy my first year. And when you're a first year law school student, I don't know if your experience was like this, but I couldn't really find anybody who wanted me to work in the government. So when I went to go apply to be a sort of an intern prosecutor, my first year, I was too young. You know, that you have no experience, you don't know anything. And so they didn't want me there. So I thought, I'll go work for a private criminal defense law firm. I'll learn how these loser defense lawyers do these things so that I could go be a better prosecutor. Well, I went over and started working for the defense, and I started to, you know, to actually deal with people who have been charged with DUIs or domestic violence or drug offenses or the disorderly conduct or whatever, any slew of crimes. And I started to see that, you know, these are good people. These are people who just made one mistake, had one bad night, something went a little bit awry in their lives. And I would empathize with them. And I would say, okay, well, this isn't sort of the caricature of criminal thugs that we see, you know, rummaging around the streets, causing mayhem. This is not that at all. These are just normal, everyday people like you and I. And when I would start working with them and have to negotiate with prosecutors on the other side as a defense intern, I would be talking to these people, and I just saw that they had very little humanity, most of them. They were sort of like automatons where they just would look at a defendant, they would look at the case, they would look at the charges, they would look at their little chart, and they would say, okay, here we go, you get this sentence for this penalty. And it felt very shocking to me that this was something where if I went to a prosecutor and said, look, I know you want to put this guy away, but he's a father. He's got two kids. He's going to lose his job. His wife's going to leave him. He's going to lose literally everything for something like this. Can you please work with me? And their response largely was, no, we can't, right? This is just policy. This is what my supervising attorney told me was the case. And good luck with that. And that did not sit well for me. And so I got, you know, maybe 6 months of that before I said, I will never, ever be a prosecutor, because some of the injustices that I saw were just so egregious that I just, you know, I wouldn't be able to sleep well at night knowing that. And so that was kind of it for me. That little experience got rid of any prosecutorial ambitions. And I would never look that direction. And we've even joked at the firm that, you know, we wouldn't even want any former prosecutors to work here. It's like, we want the pure blood defense lawyers only, the people who believe in the Constitution, not those who want to stampede all over it. And so that's where we're at. And I'll tell you, I think it's very rewarding to be able to help people. You know, it's something that most of our clients are extremely good people. Like I said, it's that one-off situation where they just got into a little bit of trouble. They need a little bit of assistance to get things back on track, and we're never going to see them again. And so if we can be a part of that, then it's sort of, I think, living my purpose, and I'm very happy where I'm at.
It's an interesting thing. Like, I've never done criminal law. I've done some statutory stuff. So when you're dealing with the government, you know, they for those who don't really appreciate it, they show up to court, they have their list of 10, 15, 20 files that they're dealing with in a day. They know the files maybe more or less, but they know basically just it's formulaic. You just go in. There's no person. There's no negotiations. There's no discussions. It's just do your job. Let the judge, you know, come to whatever decision if they don't agree. And it's almost inhumane. Inhumane in a civil sense is much different than inhumane in the criminal sense. I imagine that sounds exactly like pretty much like what it's like in criminal defense dealing with these prosecutors.
Yeah, it is. It's we kind of joke that it's, you know, it's paint by numbers. Like they get the little coloring book, and they just go in there and they have to fill in, you know, put the greens on the ones and the yellows on the twos, and they just fill it in like you would in grade school. And I've done bench trials and jury trials where it's exactly like that. I mean, the prosecutor is just sort of running down a recipe, you know, like baking a cake. You need one ounce of flour, you need two eggs, you need a cup of milk, and they just follow the numbers. That's it, right? There's not much creativity that goes into it. They have sort of a David versus Goliath, I would say, you know, balance when it comes to resources. And the heft behind the government. I mean, it's massive. They've got all of law enforcement, you know, here in Arizona. It's a billion-dollar industry, multiple, you know, jurisdictions that have multiple, you know, $100 million police departments. They've got, you know, hundreds or thousands of employees there. They've got just unlimited resources. And so now it's just, it's me and a client, right? And our little law firm here going in and trying to sort of fight against that. We got to be creative. We're the ones who have to, you know, sort of think outside the box and offer compelling arguments, because the deck is so stacked against us that it's, I mean, it really is, I think, a problem in this country. And it really irritates me, which is why I wanted to start speaking out more about it.
What's been your experience early on with judges in terms of, was that a surprise? Was it not a surprise? Were you expecting some of the potential biases that exist with judges? What was your experience?
Yeah, it's something where I think I sort of have mixed feelings on it. There are certain jurisdictions in Arizona that I have a lot to say about the judges, and there are other jurisdictions where, you know, it's pretty reasonable. But it was a little shocking to me that it's a little more one-sided in favor of the prosecution than I was expecting when I first came into the law. I am seeing that a lot of judges, I often will tell clients this, when we go into court, it's not one-on-one with the judge as the mediator. It's kind of one-on-two in this court. It's not every court. Not every judge is going to be overly biased in favor of the prosecution, but a lot of them are. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. There are some jurisdictions here in Arizona where the judges' offices are literally in the same building as the prosecutors. So when they're walking down the hall past each other, you know, to use the restroom, it's, hey, John, hey, Bill. And, you know, and you, there's a camaraderie that develops when you're in that close proximity to each other. And so you can kind of see that come out in court. And you can't make a legal argument to condemn that because it's not quite ripe enough, right? It's not as obvious that there's an unethical bias that exists. But, you know, the defense knows, the prosecutors know, they all go around and, you know, they go to the break room and they all have their powwows together. And unfortunately, it impacts our clients. You know, it's something that will trickle down and it actually impacts people's lives. And so it did catch me off guard to think that there was such a sort of a close, warm relationship. I was envisioning that there would be maybe more, you know, a bigger degree of separation between the judges and the prosecutors. And you just sort of realize that it's kind of the establishment versus people who are outside of the establishment. It's the judges, they're getting their checks from the same place the prosecutors are getting their checks. They all work sort of in concert together. They all report ultimately to the various city councils around the country. And so, you know, their interests are aligned in a lot more ways than our clients' interests would be aligned with either one of them. And when I say our clients' interests, it's not just getting off of the crime. It also has to do with, you know, the protecting the Constitution, with the right to counsel, with or the right to be free from unlawful searches and seizures, and on and on and on. I would have been expecting that the judges would have been more, you know, focused on some of those issues rather than generating revenue. I mean, we have some courts here in Arizona that they run their courts like a corporation. I mean, they have profit reports and loss reports and how many old cases did they collect on, you know, how many outstanding fines and fees have been paid. And so you just start to see that it's just a big bureaucratic mess. And they're all sort of in cahoots together. And so, you know, the defense attorneys, we're kind of, the odds are stacked against us. And we're, you know, we're kind of the last line of defense for our clients. They have literally no idea what's going on. You know, they're just going in totally blind. And unfortunately, there are a lot of other defense attorneys out there who know that, and they take advantage of them. I used to work for a couple of them that didn't last long before I decided I can't deal with this either. And then we developed, you know, our own firm, and I think we're doing a good job. I think we provide people real value. We actually care about them because of some of the things that I sort of alluded to earlier about our principles and our values and things like that. So the practice of law, you know, long story short, Robert, to answer your question, is there were a lot of surprises, but we're making pivots, and I guess that's why they call it practice, right? Because it's always dynamic, it's always changing, and we're just trying to operate within the rules to the best of our ability.
Rob, I want to go right back to the beginning, because we'll get to the how you got into YouTube, because from what I was able to chart, if anybody wants to go back and see some cringe videos from Rob, go back to the first videos. It's amazing to see people's evolution on YouTube, but we're going to get to that in a second. But going back to the beginning, Barnes and I talked about something, or, you know, at what we were like as children, you know, to sort of not understand, but just to put into context as to what we became as adults. growing up, what type of kid were you? Troublesome, following the rules, breaking the rules, defiant, or obedient?
Yeah, I think I grew up very quickly. I will tell you that it wasn't the best upbringing. You know, I tend not to try to make my life, you know, play the victim Olympics, make it worse than it is and sort of dwell on any of that. But it was, looking back in retrospect, it was kind of a difficult upbringing. You know, oldest of three boys, my middle brother, Joey, has Down syndrome. So that was a little bit of a challenge. He's 1 year younger than I am. And so we dealt with a lot of that growing up. You know, some of his specific needs for people with Down syndrome, you know, are elevated rather than, you know, other individuals out there. And we had some schooling issues and things like that. Single mom, grew up extremely poor. My youngest brother, Eric, is 3 years younger than me. And so we dealt with, you know, sort of, my mom was very poor until she sort of got her feet under her with her career. And that didn't happen until I was really in high school. And so, you know, very poor, living in sort of rundown neighborhoods, had bad babysitters and people that, you know, my mom could afford just to kind of come keep an eye on the kids. And so at a young age, I would say the steward of the family. You know, there was no real fatherly influence around for much of my life. And so at a young age, I was taking care of my two younger brothers, Joey and Eric. And that sort of, I think, set the tone for a lot of my life. You know, I kind of was growing up under that image or that idea that I had to take care of a bunch of stuff. And I think that made me sort of who I am today. You know, I was sort of always really disdainful of authority or people telling me what to do. I had a lot of babysitters come in when I was a kid who were just off the rails. I mean, you know, not like with drug problems, you know, potentially, you know, some sexual stuff going on with them. You know, the list goes on about the problems. And I don't blame my mom for that at all. My mom is incredible. She's the most important person in the world to me. And I owe basically all of my good qualities, I give the credit to my mom for those. The bad ones, those came from other places. But, you know, the upbringing led me to where I am today in large part because I think that when people would come into my life, when babysitters would come in and they would try to tell me what to do, I just had this instinctual reaction to that. I didn't like that. And so I kind of had an anti-authoritarian bend, I would say, most of my life. And it's something that was also cultivated by my mom, I would say, as well. She is somebody who is, you know, she can be pretty stubborn. She's got a thick head. She likes to get stuff done. She likes things her way. And so a lot of that rubbed off onto me, which is sort of perfect for a criminal defense attorney, to be anti-authoritarian, to be somebody who doesn't like to just follow the rules because of whatever inclination that is, whether it's nature, whether it's in my genes, you know, I don't know, but that's kind of where it evolved from. And that's kind of the quick and dirty of it there.
Can I ask your dad, what happened? Left, not known, or deceased?
So divorced. Yeah. My father and I don't have much of a relationship anymore. He sort of was written out of my life. So I'll give you the more recent history of my life. So I am also somebody who is a recovered alcoholic. I was a big drinker when I was younger. I started drinking when I was in fifth grade, and that sort of evolved throughout my life. I was drinking, you know, off and on. I would go, my first drinking event was when I was in fifth grade. Many people probably can relate to this. I went down to a friend's house. His older sister was throwing a house party. She was in high school. I was about 12 years old. So the older kids wanted to get the younger kids all drunk and messed up. And they did that. And that was my first experience with alcohol. And I really, really liked it. And so I was always dabbling with it throughout most of my life. And I sort of break it up into these different categories where I evolved from fun with alcohol into category two, which is fun, but I'm starting to see some problems. Then I go into category three, which is mostly problems with a little bit of fun. Then category four is just problems, right? The fun has just evaporated. And so my life sort of went through that progression. And I would say that I was in category two, you know, a lot of fun with some problems, mostly through high school, all through, you know, middle school, some in college. I started to see more problems with alcohol in college and through law school. And then something happened in 2016 that just catapulted me into that category four position where it was just problems. And so, as I mentioned earlier, I'm the oldest of three boys. In 2016, as I was going through a lot of my background with alcohol, my younger brother, Eric, who does not have Down syndrome. So it's Robbie, Joey, Eric, and Joey has Downs, Eric does not. So as I was going through my progression with alcohol, my brother was also having a lot of problems with opioids. What happened with him is he broke his wrist doing, you know, a sports, BMXing, football, and whatnot. And he broke his wrist. He had to get a plate put in there with a lot of different screws. He had multiple surgeries, I think about half a dozen different surgeries. And so, you know, those of us who kind of know the story know where this is going. He was prescribed a lot of pain pills, a lot of opiates. Doctors were just prescribing him pills out the wazoo. I mean, different doctors, lots of different pills. Suddenly, the country gets aware of the opioid epidemic. They start to recognize this is not good, and we're starting to see people die around the country. So the prescriptions just got cut off. And so he turned over to heroin. And so for a long period of time leading up until 2016, we were helping him. He was in and out of rehab, in and out of treatment, trying to figure this out. He lived with me for a certain period of time until I found him dealing drugs out of my house. That's obviously not a good thing for a licensed criminal defense lawyer, where the cops already don't like me. And so if my brother's doing that, that could be highly problematic for me. What's that?
Sorry. It's cut off momentarily. Go ahead.
Yeah. So that was something that, you know, was a big thing for me. I had to basically throw my addicted brother out of my house. It was a rough period of my life. And so in 2016, my brother started to kind of get his stuff back together again. And he was up in a treatment center up here in Prescott, and he came back home. And for a couple months, it looked like we had turned a corner. We'd been dealing with this heroin problem for a very long time. Meanwhile, I'm in the sort of the throes of my alcoholism. I'm just sort of like, well, alcohol's legal. It's not a big deal. I can keep all my stuff together. And my brother is somebody who needs the help, not me. So I was sort of oblivious to how I was using alcohol and how I was living my life. And it's funny, you know, Viva mentioned my old videos look pretty bad. They do, because I was drinking myself to death all the time, right? My face is bloated. I'm overweight, and I don't look particularly healthy. And so, I'm in the middle of that while my brother is struggling with his addiction. And this is something that is happening across the country still to this day. This is not over, right? This is something that is very prevalent. And so in 2016, I got a call from my mom. I woke up one morning. I was still hungover from the night before. I think it was a Saturday morning, doing whatever I was doing. And I picked up the phone, and I heard on the other end just a blood-curdling scream from my mom. I knew exactly what had happened. She had went down to my brother Eric's apartment, and she had found him dead. He died by suicide. So, you know, that was something that happened in my life that catapulted me from sort of this, I would say, mild grade, low volume alcoholism into full blown alcoholism. And I just started to sort of numb my pain through alcohol. And that was something that I dealt with basically until about 2018, when I started to sort of recognize that this is becoming problematic now. I mean, really problematic. I had other people in my life telling me, hey man, we got to have a conversation about this. My business partner brought it to my attention. I knew it, right? And so then I went and got some help, and eventually worked my way through it. I'm now a part of a men's group. I have a 12-step men's group that I work with every week, and I help coach other guys through sobriety and help, you know, move them past the same addiction issues that I was having. And it's been something that's dramatically changed my life. I mean, it has helped define me. And I think it's made me a better criminal defense attorney in many ways, because now I can identify with exactly what some of our clients are going through. You know, we have a lot of people who just refuse to come to terms with the fact that alcohol might be the cause of their fifth DUI, maybe, you know, but they don't want to admit it yet. But now I can understand why, because I had my own struggles with alcohol, and it's something that, you know, I wouldn't wish on anybody, but I am very grateful for it, because I've learned to deal with a lot of the inner turmoil of your mind. I've learned to get control of that, deal with my resentments, deal with, finding something greater than myself to put my power in, you know, a God or a higher power, whatever that looks like. And so there's a lot of tools and techniques that are a part of that program that I think that we can take and use in our lives, whether you've got an addiction or not. I happen to have one. And now I'm maturing as a person. I am evolving as a defense lawyer. And I think I'm more connected with life in general. And so it's been a long journey, and I'm very fortunate that I ended up here. I could have easily been dead. I mean, I was drinking that much at one point in time, and I feel very blessed that I made it through, and now I feel I have an obligation to go out there. There's other people in this world who are drowning in the ocean, and we can help drag them ashore and provide value to them and make sure that they stay on the shore and that they can get back on their feet.
What was your first trial experience like?
My first trial experience? Oh gosh, that was not good. Let's just say that. It was not good. I would say woefully, well, I got to be careful here. Let's just say I was not properly educated on some important things by my bosses, and it didn't go well. Let's just say that they threw me a file and they said, go down to court and go handle this thing. And I had never done anything like that before. And I gave it my best shot. I didn't commit any malpractice or anything like that. Like, I was ready to rock and roll. But it was a little bit troubling to me that this was something that was actually happening in the legal world, that they would just basically throw people files and you could just go and represent somebody who's being charged with something pretty heinous. And so it was something that I learned a lot. My early career was sort of trial by fire, and it wasn't a good approach, I don't think. And so we have tried to not do that here at our firm. We have a program where we have interns who get to come into the office and work for a certain period of time. And then they take a break, they go and study for the bar. Then they come back. We have a little training structure for them. We're not going to throw anybody into a class 4 felony case right out of the gates. We're going to start them on some traffic stuff and work their way up, because that wasn't my experience. And now, those attorneys, I'm obviously no longer at that firm anymore, but they got in trouble with the bar for other reasons. And, their business sort of fell apart because they were doing things the wrong way. They were trying to throw a bunch of work on the back of the next mule who would come through the door that they could, they could just send off to court, tell them to go make them a bunch of money, and they could just sit back and collect the checks. It was a good short-term strategy, but didn't work out long-term. And I think it's a disservice to people who want to, go be good lawyers. It's those types of people who give the rest of us really bad names. And so we're out there trying to correct some of that today.
It's interesting, actually, at the big corporate firms, it's always the balance between the two is that the big corporate firms, they groom you, they train you. You don't get to do anything independent until you're second, third year lawyer, and it drives certain lawyers crazy. The flip side, if you go to small firms or you go try to learn on your own, and it's trial, what is baptism by fire. The smaller firms, they give you the file, read it. They don't brief you. You go to court, you get chewed out by a judge. Civil matters tend to be, have fewer repercussions, real repercussions than criminal. So I can't imagine what trial by baptism by fire is like in the criminal sense.
Yeah, it's not a good thing. Unfortunately, it's all too common. I don't think it's, I don't think it's something that ultimately results in many people, going to prison for something that they shouldn't have. Like, there's a lot of safeguards in the system that I think would prevent that from happening. And I don't think it got to that, to that level, but I certainly do think it's a disservice to the people who ultimately need it. You don't want to be in a position where you're having to sort of sugarcoat, or let's say, sell an idea that you're not 100% sure about. I think that it's a disservice to everybody. And I didn't like practicing law that way. I didn't like it where they would just say, here, go solve this problem. And they would take cases that were totally outside of our wheelhouse. They would just take a case that was totally unrelated. Like, we're not even licensed in that court or licensed on that issue. We don't know. We can't take that. But there's a very high profit motive for a lot of private firms that I think many people don't recognize, that can sometimes manipulate the people on the top. And so you just got to be cautious. If you are out there shopping for attorneys, a law firm is like a business, like many other businesses. And sometimes people forget that. They get kind of caught up by the hype of, I'm talking to a lawyer, and this person's, they're on a pedestal to some extent. And so we should just trust them with everything. And there are really a lot of bad actors out there with lawyers. And, on the show, we call it Watching the Watchers. I don't pick on lawyers too much, but when there are other lawyers who have done something inappropriately, I want to make sure that our side, the good lawyers, call them out, because I sort of demand that same standard from law enforcement and from people who are in the police departments. When they see bad stuff, I expect them to call it out. The fact that they don't is reprehensible, in my opinion. It's sort of letting this stuff lie under the radar within the departments. And I think that attorneys should be doing that same thing. And we do, I think, to a better extent than law enforcement, because we have a lot of our stuff is publicly available. You can go look up my record on the Arizona State Bar. You can see, have I been disciplined? Have I been in trouble? What's the background there? And so I think that attorneys do a little bit of a better job than maybe some other industries do, but there is still a lot of room for improvement.
Were you surprised at all about how the police are, from your preconception going into criminal defense to witnessing how cops operate, especially when they take the stand and the like in real life criminal cases.
Yeah, I'll tell you a story about when I was in law school. So my first year, I think it was my first year, it might have been my second year. As I said, I wanted to go back and become a better prosecutor. And so I was working at a defense attorney, a very good friend of mine, one of my best friends. His dad was a police officer at the Phoenix Police Department, been there for, 18 years, something like that. And so I told him, I said, hey, I want to do a ride along. I'm a first year law school student. I'm working over at a criminal defense firm. Can you set me up with a ride along? And he said, yeah, I got the best guy for you. And so he knew somebody else in the Phoenix Police Department who is somebody who writes a lot of tickets. And I mean, just goes hog wild. Everybody knew him as the guy who's every day just arresting people, impounding cars, charging DUIs. He's one of those officers. And there are those guys. There are some officers who just kind of, they show up and do their shift like anybody. And then there's that officer who's out there to just crush justice or whatever they want to define it as. And so, they're going out and doing that. And so I said, okay, perfect. Put me with that guy. So I went down to the precinct or one of the substations here in Phoenix. And I was in the facility with all of these other cops, and they were all just, it was like a frat house almost. I mean, they had, all of the sodas and candies and chips and all that. And they were all just BSing with each other. And it was kind of fun. It was kind of interesting to see that side of things, because this was my real first experience behind the curtain, behind the scenes with law enforcement people. So I get down there and we go out and we do a ride along. And I was with him for probably, 8 hours, maybe. We did a night shift. I think we finished up at about 1 a.m. We didn't get any DUIs or anything like that, but it was very, very interesting how this officer approached his enforcement. So what he would do is he would sit there. We did a bunch of traffic tickets, a couple driving on suspended licenses, impounded some cars, mostly traffic related stuff that night. But every single time after we would get out of the car, so he'd pull somebody over. Pulled one lady over for a license plate light, right? The light, the back of your license plate needs to be illuminated here in Arizona, I think elsewhere in the country. And if you don't have that illuminated, that's just an automatic basis for a traffic stop. So he was pulling people over left and right to try to see if he could find a DUI or some illegal drugs or whatever, using these pretextual bases, right? That person wasn't doing any bad driving. He just had a light bulb that was out. Now, it's not the crime of the century, but that was the original basis for the stop. And so, I kind of, that didn't rub me the wrong way. I kind of knew that, yeah, they're going to use whatever they can. I kind of expected that from the police. But what we did then is afterwards, this guy would write a full ticket. So, sections 1 through 6, boom, 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 tint, loose this, a broken that, and just write it all up. And I'd go, that's kind of excessive, right? That's a lot. Like this lady, you see her, she's driving a 25-year-old car. She's got, towels on the back seat because the leather is broken, so they can sit in the car. Like she has nothing. She has no money. She's not going to be able to afford this. What's going to end up happening is she's never going to get her car out of custody because we just impounded it. So she's not going to be able to afford that. She's not going to be able to pay the fines. She's going to default on this ticket, which means her license is going to be suspended indefinitely until she can go pay those fines down. And so this woman is totally screwed. I mean, totally. Now she's got a criminal charge for driving on a suspended license. And this was just a woman who was just on her way home from the grocery store, and wasn't doing anything wrong. And so I was kind of shocked by that. And this was something that was repeated time after time. But that wasn't even the big thing. When we would get back into the car, back into his Tahoe, he would keep mental note of how much revenue he was generating. So he would go down that list and he would say, all right, unsafe lane change, that's 250, following too close, that's another 275, driving on a suspended license, she'll never get her car out, so that's going to get turned over to the state, they're going to sell that at auction, that's probably $2,000, and he would just go down the list, okay, and just keep a receipt going. He'd basically open up a tab that night, and we would close that one out, go pick up someone else, he would do the same thing again. By the end of the night, I don't remember what the number is. I mean, I wrote about it in my book, but it was tens of thousands of dollars, like in the $60,000 to $70,000 of revenue that he generated. And the way that he framed that conversation was so shocking to me. I'm thinking, whoa, this is crazy. I'm a first year law school student. I thought that these police were supposed to be out there, picking up the bad guys. I didn't see any bad guys on that night. I saw a bunch of good people who were trying to live their lives, and they just got bombarded by this police officer. And it actually, I'm not kidding you, it actually made me feel sick to my stomach what I saw. I mean, I saw some people who, there was one lady who was driving home. She had her 14-year-old daughter who was sick in the car, laying in the back seat. Their car got impounded. They had to walk home in the middle of the night in Central Phoenix. I mean, it was insane. And that was something that really, really, I was still a first-year law school student. I was sort of waffling. Do I want to be a prosecutor? You know, do I want to go do the Harvey Specter thing where you put the suit on, run for office one day? Do I want to go that route? And that incident with that officer and that ride-along just totally shook me out of it. I wanted nothing to do with any of those people. And it became kind of a personal mission, actually, to push back against any of that overstepping. And so it was a wild experience. I learned a lot. I wish it was something that I could communicate better to other people, just so they could see that side of how this all works.
No, it's an amazing thing. It's like, it is to some extent the administrative state, like it's more laws, less justice, where what you're describing for the criminal side, it exists for the civil, you know, the civil administrative side. And by way of example, I mean, I'm on a boat in the summer, in a lake in the middle of the Laurentian Mountains, not my boat. And we get boarded by two cops carrying firearms. Cops. They. I'm with three kids and my wife, and they stop us in the middle of this lake. Two armed cops get on the boat, keep us there for 45 minutes, grill us on fire extinguisher. Where are the paddles? Where are the lights? Well, not lights. The flashlights. Let's see your life jackets. Can we see the dates on them? Oh, this one. We had 20 life jackets on the boat. Two of them didn't have the dates because they wore off. And they're like, you shouldn't have these on the boat. It's like, well, we got 18 others, literally. And they write a big fat ticket, a bunch of them. Yeah. And one of the registration numbers was peeled off the outside of the boat, except you could still see the silhouette. You just couldn't see the sticker. And, you know, it was, I don't remember how many hundreds of dollars the ticket was, but it's just boom. And it's they're administering idiotic laws that are put into place in the first place that just are oppressive on the citizenry. And if you're connected, if you're wealthy, you can deal with it. And if you're not, you bear the brunt of it. It's a
tax on the poor. I mean, the poor people are the ones who can't afford this stuff. If some rich person driving, you know, a Lexus, Tesla, whatever, you know, gets stopped, $1,000 fine is not that big of a deal to them. You know, they're going to be able to get rid of that. The other, you know, it's the people who can't pay it. And then what happens is they default. So everything gets suspended until the fine gets paid in full, and they add on a bunch of additional penalties, non-payment fees, time delay payment fees, payment plan fees, and it just goes on and on. So then people are just so buried in debt, they lose their license, they can't drive, they can't get a job, and the consequences just continue to compound until the end of the day. We kind of joke in criminal law, we say, and I get a lot of pushback on this, and there's a lot of people who don't like my take on the police, but we say that they're not out to serve and protect. They're out to tax collect. And you see that. You see a lot of that happening. There's, you know, in Arizona, we have photo radar around, and everybody talks about this is saving lives and stuff. But you go over on the court website and you see that they're making $6 to $7 million a year off of this stuff. I mean, it is big, big money. And many people forget about that. So when I hear these politicians talking tough about, you know, cleaning up the streets and eliminating crime and all of that, it's like, is that really what you're focused on? Or are you out there trying to get Viva, you know, off the boat, you know, in handcuffs? Like, what are you trying to do?
And because
it doesn't make sense.
And the cities ultimately end up budgeting for the revenue from tickets. So they forecast their budgets based on what they expect to collect. And some of the people saying, you know, there's no quotas. When your budget projects income from infractions, you may not have quotas, but it's budgeted for. And if you don't get them, you don't meet your budget, and then you don't meet your thick payroll. The administrative state becomes a business, and it becomes an oppressive business at that.
Right. Well, you don't have a quota. You don't have a quota to make videos either, Viva, but you do, right? You do, because that's your job. And this is what you do on a regular basis. It's the same thing with the police, the no quota argument. It's like, yeah, but they're police officers. That's their entire job description. They don't need to have a quota because that's what they're supposed to be doing on a daily basis. Otherwise, they would not be police officers anymore.
Well, also the numbers revolution, which was popularly portrayed in the show The Wire. There's actually a documentary about what's happening in New York, where New York Police Department cops are suing because they actually taped their bosses demanding they hit certain numbers. So there may not be an official quota, though I was once pulled over by a cop that'll give him credit. He said, I'm only ticketing you because I got to hit my quota this month. No, my favorite cop experience, early cop experience, was down in Mississippi when I was a kid. My brother and I were at my cousin's wedding, and they actually had it was like New Year's Eve. They have a road that has a huge hole in the middle of the road, and the cops are sitting there. And so we're driving down, and it was one of those roads that a lot of people would come back coming from New Orleans. So my brother sees this huge hole, swerves, of course. We get pulled over for swerving without signaling. Yeah. You know, it's like, there's a huge hole in the road. They hold us for like an hour and a half. They illegally search the car, of course, because this is the thing. Like, when I hear these excuses of people on the U.S. Supreme Court case that's pending about how they need an emergency excuse, a hot pursuit excuse to rush people's houses without a warrant, these are almost all pretextual. 90% of pullovers are pretextual. They're looking for something else. They're looking for a big bust. They're looking to get lucky. And you might think it's a good thing. You might think it's, some of us think it's bad because it's not really what the Constitution comports with. But these cops pulled me and my brother. I was like 13, 14 at the time. And so the only way we got out of it is I had always signed my name with a little Christian fish underneath it after my father passed away. So he sees that, the cop does, and goes, "What's that?" And he had a heavy Mississippi accent I can't do. And I was like, "Well, it's what the Christian pilgrims used to do before they were wrongfully taken away." And I was like, in the cop, "Well, we're not going to do that, 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 that." But then told me when we're leaving, don't ever come back to this town again. So, I mean that's just what what cops do well is that 80% of the country never experiences how bad cops are. And that's why, and they have the TV version, the dragnet version of police. And they have been wrongfully tarred and feathered by some of BLM and some of that. But there has been an overreaction that suggests all police are good when fundamentally on a day-to-day basis, there's still systemic and serious problems with police that you have to contest and confront in court. And in that capacity, were you surprised at all? I was even surprised the degree to which if they're a law enforcement officer, there's about a 75% chance they're going to lie at some point during the proceedings. Which has that been your, what has been your experience and were you surprised by it at all?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I do kind of the theme of the channel is watching the watchers. So we do, you know, we do come down pretty hard on the police. You know, I pick on them because of that, because I think that there is this big imbalance in society because I think that many people have that image of police officers that you just described, Robert, you know, this idea that these are all, you know, national heroes. They're all making these tremendous sacrifices. They all, you know, are sort of bleeding all over themselves to save America and enforce justice. And you're going, that's not my experience at all. Right. We have enough people out there who are puffing up the police at every single turn. They have almost zero accountability because of their relationships with the police unions and the city contracts. They are sort of immune from a lot of the same criticisms that many other people in this country are not immune from. Right. I mean, if I do something wrong, state bar comes down on me, I can lose my license. That's the end of the game. Police, they go through the, you know, they investigate themselves most of the time. They find they did nothing wrong and they just put the officers right back out on the streets. And so, you know, I think that there's enough puffing up of law enforcement in this country. I want to offer a different perspective. Now, that being said, I also don't think that all cops are bad. I've never been in that camp. I've never supported defund the police. I think that those things are way over broad and they're missing the mark, you know, and I even don't think all cops are racist. I mean, I've said this on the show repeatedly. You know, we see George Floyd, we see a whole laundry list of them. I've covered many of them on the show, Breonna Taylor, Rayshard Brooks, Ahmaud Arbery, the list goes on and on. And my issue is I think that this is a cultural problem with law enforcement that there's a incentive to paper over some of the irregularities that take place in police procedure. And so, you know, I don't know if cops are on the stand lying or they're just, you know, bending the truth in a way that they're trained, you know, whether they say this is training or whether this is active, malicious dishonesty. You know, I haven't come to a term on that. There are certain cops. Absolutely. I'll say that cop is a liar. He lies repeatedly. He'll lie every single time. So if you put him on the stand, you got to be very cautious about this. And, you know, 10 years later, I think one of our officers here in Arizona is finally after, you know, as long I've been practicing since 2013, and he's finally getting some of that karma now. But for the last 10 years or so, he's been out on the streets, you know, bending the rules and twisting the truth. And there's video evidence of it. And now it's all finally coming to light. My issue is, why did it take 10 years? Why did this officer, why was he allowed to just sort of fester on the force for a decade, if not longer than that, without any repercussions? We know what he was doing on a regular basis. There's documented lies. And there should be some recourse, but oftentimes the police departments, they circle up. You know, we hear about the blue shield, the blue code of silence and all of these thoughts. Look it up on Wikipedia. You know, it exists. There's a phenomenon amongst law enforcement agencies in this country where they protect each other. When one of their own is on their heels, they circle the wagons and they make sure that there is protection for that person. You see this on a regular basis in criminal law. You know, our clients get arrested, their mugshot goes up on the internet. Mugshot, charges, names, address, everything. It's all public record. You get one of these police officers who does something wrong, it's a media blackout. We don't hear about them. There's no images. There's no names. Most of the charges are sealed and kept under seal, really. And the public has no idea that any of this is going on. In Phoenix, we had this issue where the police departments, their union, were negotiating with the city council. And what happened is they would, as part of the terms of their contract, there was an agreement that the police department could wipe their records clean after 5 years. So if you had a police officer who did something wrong and their personnel file was marked, after 5 years, it's gone. It's vanished. So you just got to wait for 5 years and then all evidence of your malfeasance goes away. And that's not right. That's not accountability. That's not transparency. That's not, we as a society having access to information about what the people with a monopoly on power are doing and how they are governing our, how they are enforcing the laws in our society. And it just, it agitates me so badly that I started the channel and I wanted to, watch the watchers. And my earlier videos before I started kind of doing the everyday lives, I would take these cops, we would find their mugshots and we would just, I'd print them out and I would just hold them up right in front of the camera. And I'd say, this guy, John, whatever, did this crime. And we're going to memorialize this sucker right here on the internet, because what's going to happen is if we don't talk about it, they're not going to talk about it. I have Miss Faith back there. Everybody say, hi, Faith. So
We were supposed to say to start off the show. So hi, Faith. We're 51 minutes late, but hi, Faith.
Hi, Faith. She's outstanding. So I would say, hey, look, this cop did something bad. Go find his mugshot or go find an image of this guy. And so she would, and we take his image. I actually have them all posted up on my wall right back here. I can't move the camera, but I have, 50 mugshots up there from these police because I want to memorialize it. You know, what ends up happening is they get a slap on the wrist. It goes under investigation. We have internal affairs that goes on and on and on. People inquire about it and we hear the same talking points. Oh, we can't comment on an ongoing investigation. Sorry, it's still ongoing. A year goes by. Everybody forgets about it. The officer will move cities, move states, get a new position as a new law enforcement officer in a different agency. And it's still the same bad person. There's been no remediation. And I just think that's a big problem. And so one of the core values of our show is all about accountability and transparency. And that, I think, is a fair standard to apply across the board, whether it's defense attorneys, politicians in elected office, or police. I think that is something that we can all strive to.
So I got this leads me to two questions. One is going to be confession through projection, and the other one is just to get there. Robert has a theory, and we've discussed it on our streams, that the police force likes to keep some of the bad apples on the force because they're useful weapons, so to speak, to use an analogy. So, I mean, first of all, is that your experience, that the police force likes to have these bad apples who will do the dirty work that the good cops won't do? And then, which brings it into the second question, if these are truly bad apples who wield power, are armed, have access to all of your information, et cetera, do you not have the slightest bit of fear about doing what you're doing in terms of, getting one of these bad apples on your personal case?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that, that's an interesting philosophy and interesting theory. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but it makes sense just thinking about it off the cuff. There are officers that other officers know are not good officers. Nobody wants to work with them. Nobody wants to partner with them. They have a reputation that exists of somebody who, copies and pastes reports from one report to the other, somebody who is using a lot of pretextual justifications to do something else. And there is sort of this aura of that, I think, that exists amongst law enforcement officials. And you can even see it in trials. In DUI trials, you have five or six officers sometimes who will come in. Multiple people will respond to the scene. They're all witnesses. So you get a lot of them in the same room together. And I try to be friendly with officers. I actually like officers. I like the good officers and the people who do good work out there. There was a police officer who gave me one of the best gifts of my life around the time my brother died. You know, he basically prevented me from going in and going into the room where he, where his body was, right? He stopped me from doing that. And my mom, unfortunately, did not get that gift. She went in, she found him. And so she had to struggle a lot with PTSD and cognitive behavioral therapy and all sorts of stuff to get those images out of her mind. And an officer stopped me. You know, he actually stopped me and he said, "Hey, listen, I know you feel like you have to go and do that. You do not." Okay. And we had a conversation about it, and it was a major gift. And so, you know, I'm appreciative of that. I want to see more of that. And I want to lift up the good police. I really want to support them. And I do not think that what I am doing is necessarily at odds with that. I've had a lot of people ask me that question, Viva, about, you know, do you feel like you're ruffling the feathers a little bit too much? I do have some thoughts about that. Right. I mean, I am a little bit extra cautious about my surroundings and about, you know, I've got protection and certain things that I've accommodations that I've made in order to make sure that I'm okay. Mostly, but I'm also not married. I don't have any kids. You know, I'm young. I like to fight. I'm pretty aggressive in a lot of ways. And so I'm not too worried about that. I've had some officers reach out and say, somebody close to me in my life got pulled over for a traffic ticket and explained where they work and how they're associated. And they said, Oh, you work at the R&R Law Group. Oh, that's those Watching the Watchers guys. I love the show, you know, because the good cops also want this. They also want those bad cops out of there. They don't want, you know, the Derek Chauvins of the world, whether you think he's guilty or not, they don't want that to happen. They don't want that situation in their department because of the crashing cascade of ramifications that come out of it. You know, they want to do the same thing that I think most of us want out of our lives. You know, they want to do good in the world, make an impact, build a career, have a family, do good in the world. And I want to support those officers, but that doesn't mean I can't call out the bad officers. And I've had a lot of other lawyers and a lot of people in my life, you know, do some of the concern, you know, commentary. Hey, you know, you're kind of going off the rails a little bit on this stuff. And I just think it's more important. You know, I have a bigger vision for what I want my life to be and the impact I want to leave on the world. And it's not, unfortunately, it requires me to be aggressive and take on some of these strong issues. And I just intend to keep doing it. And I'm hopeful that, you know, I talk about in my intro on the show, I say we shine the big, beautiful spotlight of accountability and transparency back down on our system so that we can find some justice. And in this phase of my career and my life, I am hopeful that I can, you know, engage with a community like yours, like Robert's, that allows me to meet other like-minded people, because I think with a bigger community, we have a brighter spotlight. And that's really where the change comes in. You know, we have a law firm where we're on the ground, boots on the ground every day. I'm not in court every day, but we have a whole team of people who are. And, you know, they're fighting for justice in the courts. And so how do we bring this conversation into the public eye where we can talk about it on a national level with more individuals and bring about true reform? And I think that largely starts from the public pressure on the politicians, because I'm sick of the politicians just saying, well, we need to form a commission. We need to study this. We need to sit down and you know, bring everybody together and hash this out. It's like, no, this has been a problem for 30 years. And it's time that we start taking some action on it. And I think that the real way that we're going to do that is through some public pressure. We're seeing a lot of it right now in the Chauvin trial and others, but that's really where I think this current phase of my career is. And with more, you know, with a bigger community, with more eyeballs on it, I think we sort of get a little of that group protection, right? You're sort of not alone anymore. You've got some support. You've got some other people that are good company. And so if stuff starts to go awry, we can lean on each other and support each other in our journeys.
To what degree that does the cinematic, televised sort of portrait of criminal defense lawyers that we often see, most famous one right now, another Southwestern located fictional lawyer, Better Call Saul. How much of those lawyers really exist that you see, and how much of it is a caricature?
So I think almost all of it is a caricature. If I can be perfectly honest, being a criminal defense attorney is mostly pretty boring. Most of it, it's a lot of sitting in court. It's a lot of waiting around. Lately, it hasn't been sitting in court because of COVID. A lot of stuff has actually gone online, which is pretty nice. So you can do your emails and, you know, and sort of do other work while you're waiting on court proceedings. But a year ago, it's a lot of sitting in court. I mean, you go to court, You're in front of the judge for 5-10 minutes, maybe. You've got some brief oral arguments. It's a lot of continuances. It's a lot of reading police reports. It's a lot of doing interviews with police officers where we're actually recording, having a recorded conversation with them, asking them questions about their investigation, trying to find where they screwed up or where their inconsistencies are or how their statements don't corroborate one another. And it's a lot of that. I mean, I'll tell you, it's a lot of fun. It's very interesting. There's not a day that we have where we're bored. That's not going on, but it is a lot of waiting. It's not a lot of what you see in Hollywood and on the TV shows where everybody's walking in and slamming binders on the desk and court and, you know, shouting and somebody's getting hauled off in handcuffs. It's mostly procedural. You do have a lot of activity around the trials. I think the trials are more or less pretty fairly portrayed, you know, in the media. They're consolidated. They cut out, you know, 99% of what is actually legal realities. And it can be provocative. There can be a lot of legal errors and stuff in there, but it is a little bit more exciting. There is some fun that goes on in the trials. And I think we're seeing some of that with Chauvin too. We're seeing some interesting issues pop up. And I know that we're both covering that.
Yeah. Well, actually that was the next stage that I told everyone we're going to get to. But before we get there, actually, we're going to do Chauvin, but Real Bambunga had one question, which I think is good for both Roberts. And it was a question about reform and potentially says Real Bambuga question for Rob Viva. Please read this one. Do you think professional opinion that requiring two felons to serve each 12 person jury might help with the problems with the criminal justice system? And then we're going to talking about that, move right into what is going on with the Chauvin trial. Let's start with Robert on the bottom. What do you think adding two felons? I mean, I don't know how you do that constitutionally or even legally, but conceptually, might it help?
In other words, having two people that have a criminal record on the jury?
I believe that is the essence of the question.
I mean, the old Magna Carta, most people believe that the right to a jury is a right to a jury of your peers, because that's the Magna Carta language, because the knights didn't want to be judged by anyone except other knights because their view was no one else could understand them. I'm sure cops would rather only be judged by other cops, for example. What's interesting is that it isn't, you know, you have a right to an impartial jury, not to a jury of your peers. And we've all seen examples of juries that didn't look anything like our clients. And so, I mean, Snipes' jury, it was all, you know, it was an all-white jury pool. So, you know, there was that dynamic. But judges usually manipulate jury selection a lot more. So I think the idea is of we should have someone with that lived experience be part of the process. There's a lot of logic behind it. We would have to probably change the law to create that. It doesn't necessarily violate the Constitution, which is just an impartial jury requirement. But generally, of course, felons are excluded from jury duty because a lot of laws are based on voter registration rolls. Depends on where you're located. Various states don't allow felons to register to vote and so forth. There would definitely be a different dynamic. My own experience with the best trial court system I ever saw was the tribal court system of the Ho-Chunk, where you went to the elders and they were about reformation. They were about remedy. They were about repair, not about punishment, not about severance, not about, you know, a whole bunch of things that I think are adverse in our current system. And they bring their common sense and collective judgment to each case. They're kind of a hybrid between a judge and a jury, and they tend to be better than both in my experience. Now, I think the judge to transition to the Chauvin case has done the best jury selection I've ever seen. And I think he's unusually balanced and fair. Chauvin would have been dead to rights with a lot of judges. Once the system says you're now outside, you're no longer seen as a police officer, you're seen as a problem, they bring the whole weight of the system down on you. And this judge has gone out of his way to be balanced and fair. I think the prosecution is trying to stack the odds however possible. Now, I think practically speaking, what we're witnessing is that he probably made a mistake with venue, that it may not be possible to get an impartial jury out of Hennepin County in Minneapolis, especially after the settlement disclosure. What's your take? I thought his method, he's an unusually fair state court judge, unusually smart state. Well, I'm probably saying some things about some other judges. I exclude any other judge I'm currently in front of. They're all smart and fair, of course. But this guy really, he's the real deal. I would love to do a trial in front of this guy, given the stacked odds. But I think that, I mean, he brought people back. They're already seated on the jury, and he's having to kick them off because of what happened. And Minneapolis knew what they were doing by doing that disclosure. What's your take on the jury selection process so far, both in terms of what the judge has done and the practicalities of whether this venue can be a fair, impartial jury?
Yeah, great questions. Let me answer the felon juror one first. I think it's a very interesting idea, and I like where that is going. I like the idea that, you know, you have a more representative jury, and, you know, of course, felons, they've got some experience with the law, and they would be very, very provocative additions there. I think that's the problem, is it might be too provocative. You always got to consider the incentives, and sometimes there are perverse incentives about making changes like that. You know, if you have a 12 person jury and everybody knows that two of the 12 are felons, everybody's looking around at each other and going, I think it's that guy. Yeah, you know, that guy, maybe I'm going to vote however that guy votes, because we don't know what he's capable of. And so, you know, those are interesting things you'd have to think about. But I like the idea that people are thinking about juries and about how to have a fair jury. And Robert, I agree with basically everything you just said. I've actually been a little bit shocked at how fair and neutral Judge Cahill has been. He's been somebody, in my opinion, who has sort of held the line for both sides. We saw that in the situation of the Priors, which I think is still coming up for discussion. I think he's going to rule on that Thursday or Friday, but whether George Floyd's 2019 Prior can come in, you know, he was kind of consistent. He kind of said the defense is not allowed to bring that in, but the prosecution, you're also not allowed to bring in Chauvin's prior disciplinary record. You know, neither of those are coming in. As far as we know, that is subject to change because there's new evidence on the prior, which maybe we'll talk about. But yeah, I listened to some of the sort of second round of questioning today about the jurors this morning. For those who are not following as closely, there were nine who were seated on the panel as of yesterday evening, and then today they removed two of the jurors off of the panel because they learned about that $27 million settlement that the city council paid over to Floyd's family. And they admitted, to their credit, they said, no, I mean, I heard about that. It was a big, big settlement. I don't think I could continue to be fair and impartial. And one of the jurors was sort of, I think, kind of waffling there. I mean, if the judge would have pushed him a little bit, I think he would have said, yes, I can still be fair and impartial. And he would have been able to stay on the jury. I think another judge would have asked that one more question. They would have said, okay, I know that you heard about it. I know that this is an impact to how you're going to view the case. But all that being said, can you set that aside? And can you still be fair and impartial? And of course, the juror would have said yes, and the judge would have kept him on there. But Peter Cahill didn't do that today. There was somebody who was really close to that line, and he said, all right, listen, thank you. Going to excuse you from service, which was the right call, because it would have been, I think, a little bit too much in favor of the defense. And so I'm with you, Robert. I think that everything I've seen from him has been really, really good. And he's got a couple big decisions coming up on the 404B stuff with Floyd's priors, whether that one can come in. He's also going to be considering, I think, the change of venue stuff tomorrow or Friday, as long as a continuance. He's already been pretty clear that no additional peremptory strikes are going to be granted to the defense, because he doesn't need them, really. The judge is going to strike these people if the $27 million is an issue, and he's shown that today. So I'm actually very, very impressed with this. I think it was a great decision to bring him on to handle this trial.
Two procedural questions that some people might not know and that I'm not sure I fully appreciate. They're going through the jury selection. They cross-examine. They have the voir dire with each jury member. Then they get approved and they get seated. How did it come that, you know, they're seated, they've been approved, and what do they spontaneously say, like, ask to be put in front of the judge again and say, I've heard about this and I don't think I can go forward? Like, how did that work in how did it actually just come to be?
So the judge called them on his own. So there's a great picture of him today on StarTribune.com. They're doing great reporting. The judge is just like, his head is just buried in his hands. He's like, this thing is a circus. You know, I can't take it. And he's absolutely right. It is a circus. And so I think what happened procedurally is they had them seated. The settlement came out. Everybody heard about that. And Eric Nelson, the defense attorney representing Chauvin, came out and said, listen, judge, this is a huge problem. And he listed a bunch of reasons why. And he basically said that, you know, it's so prejudicial towards Chauvin that they need some sort of remedy here, either a continuance, either a change of venue, more peremptory strikes. And he sort of laid all of that out. And the judge said, okay, well, listen, here's what we're going to do. And the judge on his own decided to call all of the seven who were already seated back into court. And then he was only going to question them. So he did not let the prosecution or the defense ask any questions. There was one woman this morning who I think she's in her 50s. I think she's the executive assistant. I have a little chart of all the jurors that I'm keeping. I think it was her. And she was, you know, if any juror seems predisposed to be siding with Chauvin, then it's her. And as soon as the judge questioned her, said, okay, you're still on the panel regarding the settlement. That's a non-issue for her. She can still be fair and impartial, or maybe she hadn't even heard of it. I don't remember. But then the prosecutor got up and said, well, you know, I still want to sort of formalize on the record an objection to this. And the judge said, well, that's great. You can formalize it. It's great. But I remember talking to her. I asked her plenty of questions. And so she's staying on the jury. And the judge did it on his own. I think the judge has the full right to do that. If there's anything that he thinks is throwing off the jurors or jeopardizing the impartiality of the trial, he has the ability to do that. And the way he handled it this morning, I thought was great.
You know, I was thinking that he was not really going to consider transferring venue since he turned it down beforehand. And I thought the defense lawyers did a so-so job at presenting that. You know, rather than speculating, produce empirical evidence. Get a political scientist, get a pollster, do a good poll, show the effect. Because my guess is a poll of Hennepin County would have shown very different knowledge and preconceptions of the case than other parts based on other national polling that I've seen. Particularly, I don't think people in rural Minnesota would be worried what their verdict, that their lives would be in danger based on their verdict, because they don't think anybody from Minneapolis or BLM or anyone else is coming out to rural Minnesota. If anybody's been to rural Minnesota, you'd have an idea why. It's Fargo country. Yeah. It's the risk might go the other way, but so I think he may have misgauged that, but it looks like he's seriously reconsidering it because of his level of frustration. I think he's even been surprised at the degree of pretrial coverage. But I think most of us have experience. Usually, even in big cases, you get at least one out of five jurors that have potential jurors that have never even heard about the case in meaningful detail. The reality now of social media combined with riots, everybody hears everything. They can't avoid it even if they want to. It used to be you could just say, hey, we can sequester the jury, or we can just tell them, hey, don't turn on the TV news, don't read the newspaper, and that would solve 90% of the problem. Not anymore. Now they got to not be on their phones. Now they got to not go to work. Otherwise, they're going to hear about it because of the Facebook effect. But it looked like some of his way he was ruling today in some of these juror cases, like he wasn't trying hard to keep them on, felt like he's looking almost for a pretext potentially to actually transfer a venue. Now, I think it's still odds are he won't do it, but I think he's really considering it, maybe even partially as payback to the city for doing what they did. Your thoughts?
Oh, yeah. Go for it, Rob.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I sort of saw the same change that you sort of articulated there. It was my first thought on this is, why is this trial happening so quickly? I mean, you know, we know that these cases can take a lot longer. The Parkland shooting is still, you know, that was in 2018. That trial still hasn't happened. Kyle Rittenhouse just got bumped back to the end of November. That happened right around the same time George Floyd's situation happened. And trials just take a long time to develop, especially when somebody dies. You've got a lot of expert witnesses. You've got multiple things that need to happen in order for it to move forward. And so the fact that this is happening in March, I was thinking, wow, this is crazy. You know, this judge really just wants to get this over with. And I commended him for that. You know, I say often that justice delayed is justice denied. And so we want to get this through and over with. What happened here? So the city can deal with it and get back to normal. And we can kind of, you know, have some closure on this case. And so I thought, well, okay, this judge, he wants to keep the train on the tracks here because of the public intensity surrounding this case, but also because the city was a lot of preparations. We have concrete barriers, chain link fencing, barbed wire all over the place. A lot of protocols are being put in place to ensure that the sanctity of the trial is not disturbed. And the judge wanted it to happen, and he was doing everything that he could to keep it going. And now I'm seeing a little bit of a change from him. You know, now he's like, all right, we were going ahead full steam, jurors seated, and the city council of all people comes out and settles this thing right in the middle of our jury selection. I thought it was totally inappropriate. The judge is also, I think, very irritated and agitated about it today. This morning, he reamed the media for talking about some of the private notes that they were reporting on, some of the security. There was another statement from Eric Nelson, the defense lawyer, said, you know, brought up a story that potentially a judge from Minnesota, according to a Washington Post article, greenlit the settlement. And Judge Cahill said, no, that didn't happen. You know, that's not an accurate statement, but he's going to let that other judge speak for himself. And so it feels like as this continues to evolve, we're seeing more and more sort of, you know, collusion, if you want to use that term, between multiple parties in Minnesota that are really throwing this off the rails for the judge. And he's just getting agitated by it, you know, and you could see sort of his exasperation today in court. So if he did grant a change in venue, I agree with you, Robert. I thought that that was a done issue. I didn't even think that this was going to be revisited. And I was expecting kind of a open and door shut. No, that we're done with this. And that didn't happen. I think he's still going to be considering that in future rulings. And so, you know, the media, the city council, the people who are trying to make this overly political, you know, it might ultimately backfire for them if the judge starts ruling differently on some of these things in order to protect the sanctity of the trial.
Someone said in the chat that apparently the judge is going to rule or expected to rule on change of venue on Friday. So I'm not sure about that, but here's one question. The settlement in the civil case, I presume that's the settlement in the context of litigation. And so it's not just a resolution of the city council that would be public in any event, but maybe they could have kept it confidential for, say, a year. Do you think anybody can be held accountable or sanctioned for disclosing that settlement in the context of this and potentially costing however much money is going to cost to delay, change venue? Or even was it proper to release that settlement in the first place?
Well, it wasn't proper to do so, but there was no ethical limitation. I don't even think litigation had been filed yet. I think they were talking about, because normally what would happen in a context like this is they would usually also sue the individual officers. The individual officers would seek to stay the case pending the criminal case, and that would be granted. So nothing would happen. Minneapolis has always done it differently. And they knew the pattern, because what they did last time in the Moore case was they did a settlement, and Nelson sort of hinted at this. They clearly did the settlement early on, but agreed not to announce it until after the verdict came back, because they announced it on the same day as the verdict. So it's pretty obvious that you don't do a $20 million settlement within an hour of a verdict. You already have that done in advance. And I think here, I think they wanted to influence this. And the problem is, you know, Keith Ellison's son sits on the city council. It's part of this. You have the Ellison has pulled out every trick in the book. And it's one of my concerns with the left. I mean, the left used to be the champion of civil rights and civil liberties in the criminal context. Now everything's politicized. So they're willing to scratch and scrap all of those rules. We have private prosecutors being brought in, big wigs. I've never seen this level of private prosecutors brought in to try a criminal case. And I think it was deliberately done to coordinate. And they thought, hey, look, the judge had already denied venue, so there won't be any blowback. I'm sure the line guys may not have known about it, but knowing who some of those lawyers are, you can't trust a single one of them. They're enriching Ben Crump and his pals, and it makes civil rights cases look bad by Crump getting these ridiculous payouts in questionable cases. And George Floyd in the trial case in 90% of civil trials, maybe not Minneapolis, but it would have been $2 million or less, and especially when all the facts come out, because his past history does come in to that a civil case because it's about damages. And then they're like, oh, wow, he's got a long criminal rap sheet. He's got all things that don't belong in the criminal case do belong in the civil case. So it was almost like they were trying to avoid a civil trial, but was part of the settlement. And the other part was clearly to inflame the sentiments in the community to make sure this case went the right way, because I think they're kind of the big hindrance for them has been the judge is not playing ball. The judge is not. The judge wants the integrity of the system to look good. He cares more about that than any preordained outcome, and that is annoying them. The fact that he contested their overcharging annoyed them. They got the Court of Appeals to issue what I think is going to be overturned ultimately, but the whole higher up a court system is sending the signal that they'll just wait for everything to cool down and 2 years from now clarify that, oh, you know, those charges probably shouldn't have been added on. But I think he's done such a good job, it's made him annoyed. And then I think that it looked to him like they were throwing the court system under the bus by claiming, hey, we talked to the chief judge and he said everything was fine. even though the chief judge didn't preside over the proceeding. That told me that if anything had been filed in federal court, to my knowledge, nothing had been filed, but I haven't double checked that. There's nothing unethical about it, nothing unprofessional about it. You can disclose the settlement. City settlements are almost always disclosed at some point because you have to authorize the funds, and that's public information. But the timing of it was clearly designed to inflame. The other action, you know, them allowing this whole autonomous zone and the George Floyd is going to inflame. The everything else they're doing is going to inflame, and they've tried to stack the case in their favor. They want jurors. They don't want jurors on the case who are afraid of the consequences of the verdict, because they know those jurors are jurors that are likely leaning acquittal, or at least thinking about the possibility, because conviction-oriented jurors ain't worried about the consequence. They know the book deals are coming, the social media heroes are coming, the parades are coming. So I think as the judge has witnessed this, their mistake was misreading the judge. But it's because usually they get away with this. They usually get away with this 9 times out of 10. They abuse the system. I mean, in the more anti-Chauvin perspective would be, you know, the Chauvins of the world got away with this when the shoe was on the other foot. Chauvin himself stayed a cop after many, many, many complaints.
Yeah.
And at least in my experience, I agree with Robert that about 10% of cops are really bad cops. Now, you have a lot of other cops that for institutional reasons, I think will not be honest on the stand. But federal law enforcement is the worst by far. IRS, bottom of the gutter. You know, you can't be a cop, you can't be an accountant, you can't be a lawyer. Where do you go? You get a badge and a gun and you get to be an IRS agent. God bless with that. So I think with these issues I think the judge has been the saving grace of this case, but I think he might have to step it up and move the case. And historically, Rodney King verdict, Diallo verdict out of New York, when they move the venue, it changes the outcome. And what Robert's talking about, the new fact that came out was that the hypothesis that Floyd was doing this in order to get rid of drugs in his possession because he was worried about being arrested with hard drugs and what that would mean. It turns out, apparently, the reason why he was acting the way he was in his car, in the police car, was he was trying to get rid of drugs in his possession. And apparently there was evidence of it in the car, but they managed not to look for that evidence until defense lawyers asked for it 8 months later. So and there's a lot of irony here. Corrupt cops trying to screw over another maybe corrupt cop because he's now politically on the wrong side of the aisle. So there's a fascinating political dynamics. But I think I think there are major issues with pursuing. I think he wants to try to proceed there, but I think he's seeing how increasingly difficult it is. I think if he doesn't find 3 or 4 more good jurors in the next 2 days, then he may transfer a venue.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff there, Robert. My first response is about the settlement. I think you're absolutely right. They should have known better. Yeah, and we heard this come out in trial that Eric Nelson was saying, well, you know, the mayor's a lawyer and the attorney general's son is on the city council. We have the Noor settlement that took place not long ago. I don't remember exactly when it was, maybe a year ago. And they released news of that settlement the same day that they got the verdict. And so that felt appropriate. And here it was, in my opinion, something that was done intentionally. I think they had an outcome in mind. They had a consequence that they wanted to see happen. And it did. And it literally happened because we had two jurors who had already gone through a line of questioning that would determine that they're going to be fair and impartial, said, no, I can't be fair and impartial anymore, because I saw this. And how can you not, right? If the entire city council, and they use the word unanimous, you know, it's been unanimous. There's no doubt about this, that this it was an egregious offense that was conducted by the city, and we're going to pay $27 million, the highest in history there. That, how can that not bias you? And we know that it did. And so I think that is problematic to the degree that the judge is going to be looking at this now and saying, you know what, I did my best, I kept this thing going as good as we could do, and now my own sort of, you know, co-equal branches of government are coming in here and messing with our trial, and he previously didn't want to move it because he was accommodating the city. They had all of the security infrastructure in place. He had all of the media set up. I mean, this has been an excellently streamed trial. The technology's good. Courtrooms are set up. The whole thing is set in stone. But now maybe it's, well, who cares, right? I tried my way. You guys screwed it up, and now I'm going to move it on out of here.
I had two questions. First of all, someone had mentioned it to me, and now that I've seen it this way, I can't necessarily unsee it, that knowing of the settlement might make you actually prone to acquitting, because you're going to say, look, we acquit him criminally. He's already got 27. The family's got 27 million civilly. And now that I've seen it that way, I'm questioning whether or not it's just as likely anyone who would be biased by that knowledge would be biased towards acquittal as opposed to court towards condemnation. The sentiment is that, no, they're all going to be more prone to condemning because now they have sort of an indication of guilt.
So I heard that argument also from Steve Schleicher. He's a prosecutor who came back out and said, well, you know, Judge, we don't know which way this cuts, whether this hurts us or whether this hurts Chauvin, you know, kind of like, well, you know, it could go either way. And I understand that. I understand why he has to make that argument. And there is some logic behind it. You know, if the family is made whole, what do we need to punish Chauvin for? But I just don't think that is anything that's going to be communicated in the trial. You know, nobody's going to hear that. Nobody's going to hear, well, you can choose to not convict Derek Chauvin if you think that the $27 million settlement was sufficient to make his family whole again. That's never going to come into play. They're just going to move forward on the charges and run with it. And so the settlement's not even going to come into the deliberation within the jury. So they're not going to have an option, in other words, to not convict because the settlement is their sort of escape valve. They're going to have one choice. They're going to hear the evidence and they're going to have to make a decision based on what they heard in court, not use that pressure relief valve of the settlement.
Well, just briefly, one other component to that is that I think that's why they leaked the judge approval part. If I had been Nelson, the way I would have framed that for the court is it looks like the city is trying to tell everybody the court system believes Chauvin is guilty too. So because the chief judge said, yes, not only is this settlement good, publicly disclose it. So everybody knows he's really guilty. Everybody just make, you know, say the right thing when you go into court. But, you know, let's get the rope ready and the trees right outside.
So practically speaking, hypothetically, there's a change of venue. Start from scratch with jury selection, or do you take the approved jury members and expect them to commute or go to wherever the venue is going to be?
It depends on what he does. You can move venue for jury selection purposes, or you can move venue and actually transfer it to a different judge. Now, if I was a prosecutor, I was a defense lawyer, I would not want that to happen. I want to keep this judge. So all I want is an expanded jury pool. Now, the question is whether the physical trial itself takes place there in Minneapolis or takes place elsewhere. And that's where the media did massive damage yesterday and today, because the media was given access to be in the courtroom. And they used it to try to spy, and you can almost guarantee it was defense lawyers' notes they were looking at, not prosecutors' notes. They were trying to look at what the defense lawyers were writing down, trying to spy on their internal communications to be able to report it, and was ratting out to the entire city. In other words, the kind of people who could pose a danger to the city, to the courthouse, and the people at the courthouse, that is the reason for this extraordinary security, exactly what it looked like. I mean, if this was a January 6th thing, these people would be under FBI investigation tomorrow, right? If you had mapped out, oh, you go here, and then there's this security here, which means this is not protected there. That's why the judge was so hot. What's extraordinary, it's always fun when you see a judge, or at least informative, when you see a judge who's unaccustomed to politicized cases and it getting manipulated, where what he's trying to do is like, look, we need to make sure this verdict, whatever it is, people have confidence in the system that produced that verdict. And the whole system doesn't care. They just want a certain verdict. And his pushing back on it, I think he's increasingly shocked, not only by what jurors are saying, the scope and scale of prejudice that exists in the community, but the media pouring fire onto it, the pouring gas onto the fire, the to some degree, some actions of the prosecutor, but definitely the city doing so. And he keeps seeing it accelerate. He can't even trust the me press to be in the room. I mean, he didn't say it, but my understanding is one of those press people is the Star Tribune itself. So that's the newspaper in the Twin Cities. So if it was one of their staffers that was doing that, it was, they're breaching the core. And that's because in part, these journalists covering these trials for these days, they're not the old school, older, been around, the, you know, 50 years old, seen 50 trials, just want to see a fun trial, know how to obey the rules, know how to be on everybody's good side. They're political activists. They want a certain outcome, and they want to manipulate their media coverage to get that outcome, which they've also done, as Robert's been talking about, as he's tried to put up the different little images of the jurors. they're obsessed with race and gender and age. You know, the and they wanted a narrative of look at all the white guys on the jury, even though it's Minneapolis, it's Minnesota. That whole that state's a white state. That's a white bread state. And in fact, it's a far more diverse jury than is typical than it fits the demographics of Minneapolis. Now, the other reason the prosecution doesn't want to move is then it gets to all white. There's almost no African American or Asian or Latino population outside of the Twin Cities in Minnesota. You know, then it's just Norwegians and Swedes and Finns and the and whatnot. And they know rural small town Minnesota has a very different view of police than Minneapolis does right now.
Someone asked a question, any chance in a mistrial, but the trial hasn't started yet. So you can't mistrial now, right? You would just go.
It depends on the state law. I haven't looked at it. Some states it's considered mistrial. He hasn't moved for one. So I assume it's not. In some states it's mistrial once the jury selection begins. In the criminal process, constitutionally, it's only a mistrial once the jury has been impaneled. And I've actually had cause to litigate this in a civil context, won the appeal. But so the trial started in jury selection, not jury impanelment. But it depends on the case. I think in Minnesota, there's no right to a mistrial until the jury is actually impaneled.
Explain the distinction between explain what impaneled means.
Oh, until they're already selected and they take another oath. They take a first oath that they'll be honest during jury selection. Then they take a second oath at the time they're finally selected. The 14 are selected that they will be impartial during the jury process itself. Now, Robert, what's your view? My view is that this was as of yesterday. I got to take a look at these new two and the new one that was added. But they managed to go back. You know, it went from 9 to 8 while adding one. Was that 6 of the 9, if I was a defense lawyer, if I was guessing, leaned guilty. Based on a range of comments and statements, but 2 or 3 were open to acquittal. What's your take?
Yeah, I think that's actually a fair number. I think I had it at six three ish. Also, I have this little emoji chart. You know, I'm small right now, so you can't really see it. But there's demographics in here, and this is not up to date. There were a couple people who did get removed out of here. So today, I have not updated this yet. I need to do it. I'll do it tonight. But this person, number 6, the Hispanic individual who was a driver in his 20s, married, he's not on the panel anymore. And we also lost, I think it was number 4, also another white male who was a sales data guy. I think it was him. I couldn't tell if it was him or the first person. But then I went back and the juror number 2, which I think is the first person who was seated, ultimately stayed back on. The judge questioned him again and said that he could stick around. So they lost number 6. They lost number, I think it was number 8. This person here is also gone. No, I'm sorry. It was the Hispanic guy and a white guy. Those are 2 gone. So now we have the real number 8 now is another black male. So I think we have 3 people of color, 2 white women in their 50s, another woman of color, and then I think maybe 1 other white male. So actually the demographics when it comes to race shifted pretty dramatically today. There was, I think we lost a white person and an African-American person made the panel. Now, a lot of people are drawing conclusions from that and saying that, you know, people are just going to vote on race. And I'm not so sure that is the situation here. I'm not so sure that I necessarily believe that. The last person who was added today, number 8, sort of sounded like, you know, I'm not a defund the police kind of guy. And, you know, speaking politically now, and of course, racially charged, you know, this is how this trial is going. And a lot of people get uncomfortable talking about this, but this is just how law is practiced, right? This is just how this works. People are considering these things like age, race, gender, profession. I've gone through, you know, continuing legal education and had jury, education picking classes where they're talking about what news sources do these people watch? What kind of bag do they have? What kind of clothes are they wearing? I mean, you can really get that detailed with some of this, but I think largely a lot of people, some of the white people, let me say, seem to be more liberal, more in favor of justice reform, whereas some of the quote people of color, using their language, not mine, seem to be the opposite of that. You know, they sort of say that what they saw felt like it was just a bad law enforcement interaction that went wrong, and that maybe Floyd should have acted differently. I mean, that's kind of what I'm hearing, and they're not sort of a slam dunk juror that I think many people would believe that they would be just based on their race. And so we talk a lot about it, but I always kind of caution people that that is not what decides the outcome of this verdict. You know, there's a lot more that goes into it. And so I know some people, and somebody mentioned to me, Robert, that you think that, you know, that this is a huge, basically the case can be won on jury selection. And I don't disagree with that, but I am very curious about some of these other issues like George Floyd's prior, which you brought up previously, and the change of venue and the settlement and the possibility of a mistrial. I think this is going to be a major battle of the experts about, you know, George Floyd's 11 nanograms per milliliter in there, in his blood, of fentanyl and some other substances. And so, you know, I am interested in jury selection just because it's interesting, and you can kind of gamify it a little bit and, you know, and throw out odds and look at race and look at age and look at professions and sort of, you know, handicap the whole thing and see how you do. But really, I think that a lot of this is going to be based around, you know, if you can bring in the prior, that might change the whole outcome. And I can actually tell you a story about that. So we've been doing these talks on Clubhouse after the show, after we do our show. I'm not sure if either of you are on Clubhouse. Both of you should be, though. It's a lot of fun. And we have these little chats that we have after the show, like live Q&A and live discussion. And I originally came out with a defending Derek Chauvin video, and a doctor came into one of these Clubhouse rooms and she said, "You are totally wrong. You're wrong about everything. 11 nanograms per milliliter, totally off. You could have that level." I referenced a study that I found where it says that people die between 3 and 6 nanograms per milliliter. I referenced the abstract in the study. And I said, George Floyd's at 11 nanograms per milliliter. You know, this is something that would kill a normal person. And so she came in and she just kind of ripped me a new one on that particular day and said, I'm a doctor. I'm a medical professional. I know what I'm talking about. You don't." I said, "Okay, thank you for the input. You know, this is what's going to happen in trial."
But hold on a second. I mean, what did she rip you on? Did she say, is the argument that when you become habituated to fentanyl, you can not have that as a lethal dose? Or did she say it was even worse than that?
Yeah. So it was that's not enough to be the clearly determined cause of death. Somebody who uses a lot of fentanyl could operate normally at that level. And I was thinking, well, all right, well, maybe that's the case. I'm not an expert witness. I'm not a medical doctor. I would not be somebody who would be testifying about any of this at trial. I would bring in somebody who could, and I would ask them the questions. But this is what my argument would be, right? We have studies that show that somebody dies at 3 to 6. Floyd was at 11. And the jury can draw the appropriate conclusion from those facts. So that was position number one. But then the trial started to evolve. Eric Nelson gets up there. They talk about introducing this prior of George Floyd from 2019 that I had never even heard about at all. And apparently what happened back then is George Floyd was also arrested. Very similar situation. I think he was driving his car at that time. And it's funny. It's almost 1 year apart. So, you know, this new one was May 2020. The old one was also May 2019. Very similar set of facts. He's in his car. Officer comes up. In 2019, the allegation was that he ingested a bunch of drugs in order to hide them. And that turned into a whole, you know, George Floyd was hospitalized. People were telling him that your heart rate is so high, your blood pressure, you're going to have a heart attack if you don't calm down. I mean, this was something that they basically knew back at that time. And as soon as I heard that, my mind was going the same way. Well, wait a minute. If we know that in a previous case, he ingested a bunch of drugs at the last minute, then you could sort of extrapolate that to the 2020 case. And so what if that happened? Let's hypothesize and say, if George Floyd, soon as the cop in the 2020 case came up, tapped on the window, said, "Hey, what's going on in there?" We all remember that part of the video from the officer's body camera. George Floyd is clearly, you know, scared, freaked out. There's an image floating around that he's got something in his mouth, whether it's a piece of gum, whether it's saliva, or whether it's fentanyl pills. Nobody knows, because it's just a grainy image on his tongue from the officer's body camera. And so if he, let's say that was fentanyl, what if he consumed that? You could sort of reconstruct the timeline, right? He gets pulled out of the car. He's set aside for a little bit. About 15 minutes later, he's dead, right? And that would sort of correlate with the intake of a large quantity of drugs, the processing of it, and then the death of that person if they took a lethal dose, right? By the time your body absorbs it and metabolizes it, that's where you die. And you can sort of match that timeline to what we see here from the body camera videos. And so that doctor came back in after that evidence came out in court and said, I'm sorry. You were totally right. I was totally wrong. I now believe that, if they can show that he did consume a lot of drugs rapidly at the very last minute, then we have to identify sort of where he's at on the absorption and dissipation phases and whether or not that was the ultimate cause of death. But you can see it's a provocative thing. If he did that in 2019, who's to say that this is not just his modus operandi? This is just what he does.
I would actually be less interested in whether or not he had done it in the past, because that might be something along the lines of it's not victim blaming, but an irrelevant prior. But if he did it in the past and it landed him in the hospital in the past, then it's not so much the alleged criminal act in the past. It's rather the effect that had on his physical well-being at the time. Then it's relevant, not from a criminal history past. It's relevant from a physiological, toxicological, or whatever body response system. So I had never heard that either. I would make the argument that admitting that is not admitting a question of criminal history, but rather showing what the defense presumably would argue is a physical response that he had in the past, to argue that is presumably similar to what happened in this particular case.
Yeah, if I was the defense, I would have made a better argument than they did. They presented the argument talking about modus operandi and scheme, exceptions to 404 that are about usually the defendant. They don't really apply to Floyd, and the court wasn't buying it. The correlation is what you're talking about, Viva. It's causation. In other words, you say, hey, I'm not saying that any of this evidence had any impact on Derek Chauvin's intent, because clearly he wasn't there. He didn't witness it, didn't know it, couldn't see it. Though, certain experienced cop defendants would claim that they did, by the way. I mean, they would say, oh, yeah, I was familiar. I happened to be in a class and someone talked about it, and boom, they would know all that by time of trial. And by golly, they knew about it beforehand. And that's why they were so worried. Apparently Chauvin's not going to take that tack. But I would have made a causation argument, and I would have made an old chief stipulation proposal to make it easy for the judge. Say, judge, if the prosecution will simply stipulate that he took to just two facts, that he ingested this amount of drugs right after his arrest, and that he was evasive of police for those purposes, and that just those two facts, he probably wouldn't allow in the second, but he would probably allow in the first, and say, if they'll stipulate to that, I'll withdraw the request to introduce any aspect of the tape, all the salacious components, all the really components that aren't really relevant and are unfairly prejudicial to the prosecution. That'll put the prosecution more of a bind than what they did propose, because it's obvious to the judge the defense wants the salacious components in, to say, hey, look, this guy's a habitual criminal. Every time the cops pull him over, he's trying to dodge him and evade him so he can get rid of all the contraband he has on him. And he's very familiar with interacting with police because of his extensive criminal history. And you get into some of that. That's what they want to just say, Floyd bad, don't convict. And if they would have focused on the more narrow part that was viable, the causation element, they would, I thought, had a better chance. And if I was the prosecution, what I would be prepared to argue is, yeah, this same event happened in the past, but Floyd didn't die. He didn't go to the hospital till an hour later. So what was different? What was different was Derek Chauvin sticking his knee on his neck for 8.5 minutes. But the prosecution didn't really go there either. Instead, the prosecution tried to say, this is just a smear, when there is a causation component pertinent. So neither side, I thought, made the most efficacious arguments. But what it really reveals is how much the press has done such a good job suppressing information that undermines the Floyd narrative that they wanted. The real narrative underneath it, particularly more for the other cops, than in my view, than Chauvin, given Chauvin's history and his behavior that day, is that Floyd was a habitual criminal who tries to get rid of criminal evidence, who wouldn't comply from day one and acted crazy in order to help get rid of evidence. And he was doing it all the way through. He was crumpling up the dollar bills while he was in the car. Then I believe he was ingesting some drugs to try to get rid of him that way. He was trying to drop drugs. So he was doing this whole, I'm scared, I think you're going to kill me. Not because that was his real experience, in my view. In my view, it was because he'd learned this is an effective way to back the police off a little bit while you get rid of as much evidence as you can before they can do anything about it, when you don't have a toilet nearby to dump it all in. Yeah. And he was probably already high at the time, or had done drugs right before then. Someone saw him nod off in the car. So he was still in the car right after he passed a counterfeit bill. You don't normally do that. You don't hang out at the place, see how long they catch it's a counterfeit bill. So I think if people knew the whole story, the emotional narrative, the moral narrative is nowhere near as strong as the media has presented it as. But from a legal perspective, there's still a problem for Chauvin of 8.5 minutes. He's on the guy's neck, when at least 3 or 4 of those minutes he wasn't moving. So what's your excuse to restrain him when he's not moving? Yeah. That's Chauvin's biggest problem. And then it's compounded by the jury because in like looking at the changes that Robert just noted, I would say right now it's 6-2. I agree. Like the Hispanic guy I thought was good for Chauvin. So him being gone is a problem. And then I think I agree that when we were talking before the trial started with Eva and I said I would actually try to pick older African-Americans that have been victimized by crime. Men, yeah. Not women. Mothers would see their son at George Floyd. But I would pick African-American men, Latino men who've seen the worst of crime. So they'll recognize Floyd in a different context, not from the white liberal fairyland fantasy.
Yeah.
One question is, first of all, someone said Barnes versus Barnes. I want everyone to appreciate that this is the exercise that good lawyers would go through is, you know, view this and strawman it from both sides. How would the defense be able to turn this fact for their benefit? How would the prosecution be able to do that? And it's a good point, Robert. You say, yeah, it happened in the past. And guess what didn't happen the last time? He didn't die the last time. And so what's different? It's a very interesting argument. Apparently from the headlines from NBC, if you trust it, the judge has refused to admit the priors. That's what people are saying in the chat.
He said he's reconsidering that ruling.
Okay. Now, the second, this is my question. Talking about the race and everything like this, we have seen in the past where ambiguity as to who is white and who is not in certain statistics and whatever. In this particular case, it's a ridiculous question. I mean, I don't even know how to ask it. How many races have they broken this down into if you're going to identify? You have white, Asian, Hispanic, black. I mean, do you have
multiracial?
Multiracial. Or do they literally have these categories so that they're not misracializing an individual by calling someone who might be, Hispanic white?
Yeah, people of color was the language that the Star Tribune was using. This woman's a person of color. Okay. You know, we don't really know what that means or what that is, but that's how they're the people that don't fit neatly into a category, that's how they're characterizing them.
Which always reminds me of the old comic strip where the old conservative or the old, you know, old school Southern person, the young liberal saying people of person of color, they're saying a different version of that, just flipping the adjective. And they're like, no, you can't say that. He's like, I don't understand. Person of color. I'm not a fan of this person of color stuff, but the media is obsessed with it. And the media, I think even today or yesterday, there was a juror who they said identified as black. They focused on that, whatever that was supposed to mean. But I think, you know, it will be right now, if it's still the trial takes place in Minneapolis, if nothing from the 2019 arrest comes in, I think odds are Chauvin gets convicted, though I think the top two counts will be reversed on appeal ultimately anyway.
It has to be unanimous. 12 jury members have to vote unanimously to convict. One acquittal is a hung jury.
Yes. Now, Robert, were you surprised? Like, I was at least a little surprised at how deferential to the government the normal juror is. That because of their life experiences, 70, yeah, if the prosecution says it, that means he's guilty. The cops don't arrest innocent people, so on and so forth. What's been your, was that your experience? And two, was that surprising for you?
Yeah, this trial has been very unique because it's sort of like the roles are reversed a little bit. You know, typically the prosecution is in here trying to get in the defendant's prior bad acts. You know, the government, let's say, you know, the government has George Floyd, maybe he's being prosecuted for a crime. They would want to try to get in his prior bad acts to show that he acted in conformity with his past criminality. You know, in this current case, this is very similar to the past crimes. Therefore, we can deduce that he committed it now because he committed it previously. And that's kind of what the government does. And so there's all these rules about that, about why they can't do that, about why that's too prejudicial. It's not fair to say that somebody who, you know, committed X, Y, and Z crimes over the last 3 years automatically can be presumed to have committed this current crime. It's not fair. But the prosecution is not trying to do that now. Now the defense is trying to do that against the prosecution. And the prosecution is typically, you know, cops are to be believed, always trust the cops. Everything they do is right. They don't do anything wrong. This was all procedure. This was all done by the book. But now they're not making that argument. Now they're saying, here's Derek Chauvin, who's a monster, who violated protocol, done everything wrong, murdered this man, when that's not an argument that they're used to making. And so you can put the same hat on the defense. They're doing the same thing. You know, the defense is typically the cop did a bunch of stuff wrong, but here the defense is going, no, it was all by the book. This is a great cop. This is somebody who's just out there serving and protecting. And so the roles have been totally reversed. And it's actually like made my head hurt a little bit to try to like think through it from the different sides, because I'm so sort of instinctually, you know, in most cases, you know, things go a certain way. You have kind of the same arguments, but now it's been totally reversed. And it's very interesting just to see how it's unfolding. And I feel like even the attorneys and the judge and everybody's kind of just a little bit off, because they're used to arguing these same issues, but from the different side.
Now, do you think, like, I think there could be a Batson challenge against the prosecutors if they continue, because I think the prosecutors have only struck white jurors. And I think that you're right. They're presuming something about race that I think they're wrong about.
Yeah.
But they presume when they're prosecuting a case, they assume African-American Latino jurors are bad jurors. They try to strike them disproportionately. They just try to get away with it, come up with a nice cover story as to what's going on. But what I've been watching is they may be forgetting that you can't only strike white jurors. It, like, they let on some jurors whose statements were really pro-Chauvin. And I was like, how'd they let that juror on? And then I saw African-American or Hispanic. And I was like, wow, they're just assuming good. But part of the problem is they're setting themselves up to where I don't know what their pretext is going to be if they use the rest of their peremptory strikes just on white jurors. It'll be 9 for 9 white jurors struck. It'll be no distinguishing fact for some of them than jurors they let on that were not white. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So on the Batson challenge stuff. Yeah. I mean, we saw that, you know, I figured that this was going to come out early. I think we saw that on the very first day of jury selection. The prosecutor, made a Batson objection to the defense calling or I think using one of their first peremptories, and it was like on the fourth juror. Like, it was like the fourth person. It's like, how do you establish a pattern on number four? And so the Batson challenge, for people who are not familiar with that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Robert, but it's the idea that one side is striking people for a prejudicial reason, you know, race, gender, something like that. Yeah, some status. And again, traditionally, it's the prosecution who's, I think the original case came about because the prosecution was striking a bunch of African-Americans off of the juries. You know, an African-American defendant would be charged with a crime, and then the prosecution would try to kick all the black people off so that they could get convictions. And so now the prosecution is coming out and saying, no, the defense is striking people of color. And you're going, this is like bizarro land, because this is not how it typically works. But they were just spring loaded to fire that. The prosecutor, I think it was Steve Schleicher, came out and on the fourth juror already said, you know, and they used a peremptory. The defense said, no, this person said something wrong. And he was just, boom, just sprung out of his seat. Oh, Batson challenge. And we're going to talk about this. He's being racist. And they were just ready to launch right into that. And the judge looked at him and he's going, no. And that person said that they think he's guilty, essentially, right? And so that's a good reason to strike that person for cause. They used a peremptory to do it. And so the judge kind of just poo-pooed that and got rid of it right away. But, you know, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, it would be probably a good move for them to come and do that, especially if there is a pattern of the prosecution getting rid of all the white people.
Well, because that's my theory, is it's confession through projection. They were so eager to do it, told me they're obsessed with race. They're going to be striking people or not striking people because of race. Now, in that capacity, any thought, like, I would think if I was Chauvin defense, I might have a really hard time finding an expert willing to testify in this case. Mm-hmm. Do you want to be a doctor testifying? Like, especially if he gets acquitted, you do your job. Either you get up there and you screw up in a high profile case, or you're perceived to do so because the client loses. Nobody else who's going to rush to hire the doctor who lost a winnable case, or you actually are successful in your testimony and the person is acquitted, and then you're hated and targeted. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think this is a major problem that we're seeing in the legal community, just in general. We saw a lot of this even during the election litigation, and you know, where basically anybody who was even remotely connected to Donald was being just skewered by the media. Remove them from their honorary degrees, kick them off the boards, get them fired from their law firms. And we saw that. And I think that probably did have a pretty big impact on how some of these cases fleshed out. I mean, people were just abandoning ship because they didn't want to be in the blast zone from the media atomic bombs that were going off on a regular basis. And I think that is truthfully reprehensible for attorneys to be sort of bailing out of their their oaths, which is to go and represent people who need representation. I mean, we have an obligation here to work towards justice. And that doesn't mean that you only take cases that are politically correct or politically viable. This is, you know, I mean, speaking as a criminal defense attorney, I like cases that are the hard cases. I like working on the cases that nobody else wants to touch because I still think that that person deserves a defense. I believe the presumption of innocence is stronger than the political winds that are changing in our current environment. I believe in due process and the right to counsel and all of those things are more fundamental than me representing somebody who is politically disfavored at the current moment. And so I've been very disappointed to see that from lawyers across the country. And I've heard other people saying that, you know, if you could even make an argument in favor of a disfavored person, then you should be disbarred. You know, they should take your law license away from you because you are representing somebody that the legal community has disowned. And I think that, you know, there's probably that same thing happening with expert witnesses in the Chauvin trial. And I mean, think about Eric Nelson, the defense attorney there. I mean, what happens if he's acquitted and Eric Nelson is now the person who made all of it happen? He brought all these expert witnesses together. And if Chauvin is not getting, you know, the witnesses because people just think he's too volatile or he's too toxic, is that really a fair and impartial trial? I mean, is he really getting the ability to present the witnesses that he would like to call? And if the media is making the environment so explosive that nobody's willing to come in and even, you know, be a part of the process, be a part of the due process that every single defendant in this country should be entitled to, that's a big problem. And there's almost nothing that the court can do about that. I mean, they're running through this process right now with the jurors. They're asking the jurors, you know, do you have any concerns about serving on this trial for the next 4 to 6 weeks? And some are saying, yeah, I mean, my wife is concerned that they're going to come and do something to our family. That's sort of the implication of what their concerns are. And so the jurors are going to be protected their identities until they, you know, self-identify or until the trial's over. They're going to be kept under lock and key. Mostly we're going to speculate about their race and gender and jobs and all that stuff. But these expert witnesses are not, you know, these people are all right. We already know their names. They're already talking about motions in limine and about what they can testify and not testify about. And if the media catches that and pressure comes to bear on these individuals, maybe it's not so much about the jurors who are going to be improperly persuaded. Maybe you have an expert witness who takes a stand and says, oh, 11 nanograms per milliliter of fentanyl. Yeah, that's not a big deal. Not even a problem. You know, you can do cartwheels on that stuff because they don't want the blowback. And that is very troubling to me. And I do not like the direction that this is going, where people who are supposed to take the hard cases, people who are supposed to go out there and talk about evidence and facts, are now being sort of scared into their little cowardly corners. They don't want anything to do with it because of the volatility. And I hope that this is not something that sticks around, or that those attorneys go, you know, be a law librarian or something. You know, if you don't have the stomach to get into the game, and you're not willing to engage on those tough issues, then this is not the right practice for you. You should go and go read books, go teach a class, let the litigators, let the people who want to get into the Coliseum get out there and leave us alone while we can do our work. Don't come down and start, you know, crashing down on expert witnesses or jurors or defense attorneys or Trump's lawyers or whomever, because it's totally inappropriate. And the attorneys who are encouraging and endorsing this behavior are doing a disservice to themselves, doing a disservice to the country. And I think they should be ashamed of themselves.
Well, I'm going to tell you, this might be the time to end it because we have to save things to talk about for the next time. But Robert has talked about the political permission slip in the past. This is the media permission slip. And it's political permission slip plus the media permission slip. And I brought up a chat, you know, the media is going to dox them. No doubt there's going to be leaks. No doubt the media is going to, we talk about dog whistles, they're going to issue their dog whistles to intimidate anybody from testifying in this. And it's something Dershowitz and I talked about during our streams. This is exactly how you get to dictatorial regimes where, hey, you have enough political pressure, you have enough intimidation, people don't get defenses, and it doesn't stop. It never stops. It never stops until the system itself is totally corrupt and totally dysfunctional.
No doubt. And after the show, I'll be over at our locals chat, vivabarneslaw.locals.com. You can follow Robert at the watchingthewatchers.locals.com. They have a great little community over there. Very smart, very savvy. Robert does great stuff across the board, daily updates. I've actually been tracking large part. I was watching everything live, and then I started just tracking what Robert was doing on the Chauvin trial, because it's very thorough, very comprehensive, and no fear. And which is what we need. We need more Robert Gruelers in the world and fewer of some of the others we have in the world.
More Viva, more Barnes. I think that, you know, the more people who are out there being vocal about this stuff, the better, because there's a lot of suppression going on, and it takes a little bit of courage to stick your head up and say something, but there's a little bit of safety in numbers. And I think we're on the right side of history on these issues. And so I'm encouraging people to join us. And I really appreciate both of you. You know, you've led the way in many regards on this type of work, you know, of being vocal and taking a stand and getting out on the front line. And so I appreciate you both very much for all of that.
I never thought it would get here. At first, you know, I was just going to do review depositions from a decade ago, but this is where the trajectory of things has gone, and it's where life has the wave of life has pushed us. And it's quite beautiful. Robert Gruler, your channel is R&R Law Group. What's the, I'm subscribed to it, but I don't remember exactly what it's called. R&R Law?
Yeah, it was R&R Law Group. Then my commentary got a little too provocative, so we needed to segment it out from the firm just a little bit. So we did that. So I changed it to my name, to Robert Gruler ESQ. We still have an R&R Law Group channel. That's going to be very, very vanilla Arizona law stuff. So the good stuff's over at Robert Gruler ESQ.
All right. Promotional stuff on the one side for the professional stuff, and then commentary at Robert Gruler ESQ. Robert, everybody knows where to find Barnes and I. Gentlemen, stick around afterwards. We're going to say our proper goodbyes. But everybody in the chat, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for taking the time to bring us your comments and questions. And Sunday night, we're live with Robert again. And we'll do this again, gentlemen. If it's not here, Robert, we'll do it on your channel.
Sounds great. Thank you both.
All right, everyone.